Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Quick reminder that tonight on AM 820, we will have a two-hour New Jersey special. First at 7 o'clock, I will host a one-hour call-in about Governor Chris Christie and the state of the state. Then at 8 o'clock, we will air the audio portion of a Channel 13 call-in with the governor. Steve Adubato, who does New Jersey public affairs for Channel 13, will be hosting that. A two-hour special on Christie and the state of the state tonight at 7 on AM 820 WNYC. From Nat Turner to Malcolm X, anger has been a central and important aspect of the African-American experience. But for a certain group of very successful African-Americans, that might be changing. With us now is veteran Newsweek columnist Ellis Coase. His new book is The End of Anger, A New Generation's Take on Race and Rage. Hi, Ellis. Always great to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
16 years ago, as I referenced before the break, you wrote a book revealing the rage of upper-middle-class African-Americans who had achieved a great deal professionally and in terms of education.
Right.
That was the rage of a privileged class. But they still faced discrimination, and they were angry about it. Is it accurate to see this book as a follow-up to the rage of a privileged class?
In some ways it is. In some ways it's a very different book. But certainly the idea of looking at what I call the privileged class of African-Americans and doing a sort of look a generation past the rage of a privileged class was part of the motivation for this.
And so are you saying that African-Americans or upper-middle-class African-Americans are not angry anymore or not angry in a way that people who were the same age 16 years ago were at that time?
Not exactly. I mean, for one thing, you can't paint all of any group with one brush. And there are lots of people of all races, including African-Americans, who are extremely angry now, particularly given the state of the economy and how many things are going. But what it is saying is, one, that there is a breeze of optimism blowing through the black community, unlike anything that we've seen before. And this is not just of upper middle class blacks, it's blacks across the board. And that's picked up in polls done from the Pew Charitable Trust to Harris, to Gallup, to the Washington Post. And we can talk about those if you'd like. But in essence, what they're showing is not only are blacks more optimistic about the future in terms of themselves and their children than they were a few years back, but yeah, they're also more optimistic than whites. But in terms of anger, what I'm also saying, you know, is that you have, you know, the essential point of rage, or one of the essential points at least, was that you had a number of very well-credentialed, highly educated African-Americans who were saying, I don't care how hard I work, I don't care how many degrees I gather and how much effort I put in to my job, I'm never going to get past a certain point. I'm never going to get beyond a glass ceiling. And now part of what The End of Anger does is look at a generation which is saying, well, maybe that's not true anymore. Maybe it's possible to get to places that we didn't think was conceivable.
You categorize people by generation as fighters, believers, or dreamers. Want
right.
to talk about those categories?
Sure. I mean, one of the things, I really hadn't intended to do a book looking at generations originally, and this is an example of how research takes you where you hadn't planned to go. But part of what I did as research for this book was to do two fairly large surveys, one of graduates, African-American graduates of Harvard Business School, and the other of alumni of A Better Chance, a program which sends kids primarily who are poor and from urban areas, to some of the best secondary and prep schools in the country. And as I began to go through the data, and when I conducted, we had over 500 questionnaires filled out fairly detailed. As I began to go through the data, what leapt out at me was how differently people were coming to these issues, largely as a function of their age. And by that I mean that the youngest group, which I call the believers, who were the people who were essentially under 40, were saying, yes, there's a glass ceiling perhaps, but it's not one in my workplace, or if there is one in my workplace, I think I can get around it. They were much more likely to say, in effect, that they hadn't faced serious discrimination, at least on the job, If they had faced discrimination, they were much less likely to say, they were much more likely to say it hadn't seriously affected their career. On the other, and in fact, one young woman, a Harvard B School grad, summed it up by saying, you know, I think that these people talking about the glass ceiling are like the caged bird who don't realize that the door has been opened. So there was a certain amount of frustration. On the other hand, the oldest group, which I call Generation One, the fighters, who are people who are essentially over 65 now, these were the group of people who were saying, these kids are naive. They just have not encountered the real serious racism that they're going to encounter at some point. Their idea, you know, their notion that they can make it on their own merits is simply not borne out by our experience, and they need to get a grip on reality. So what ended up effectively sort of starting as a book that sort of updated Rage sort of grew into a book on generational difference as well.
So listeners of any generation, we want to hear your voices on this. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Does this sound like you and people you know, whether you're of the fighter generation, the believer generation, or the dreamer generation? 212-433-WNYC. Are you a young black professional hearing from your elders that just you wait and see, racism's going to come and knock you down, and you're saying, well, I don't really see it that much, or whatever place you hold in this discussion? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692 for Ellis Coase, author of The End of Anger, A New Generation's Take on Race and Rage. You can, of course, post as well to our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And guess what, Ellis? Our 10 lines are already full at 212-433-WNYC. So just give us a few minutes to screen some of those calls. We'll put people on. And tell us why you focused only on the elite, because I'm sure you would say there's a lot of anger still, you know, in other socioeconomic groups among black Americans.
Well, first, Brian, I didn't focus only on the elite, but in terms of the two large surveys, those are elite groups. And part of the rationale for that was that in updating Rage of a Privileged Class, which also looked at an elite group of African Americans, I thought it would be interesting to look at a comparable group. And underline that was part of the reason for this inquiry is an attempt to look at what's possible for those who are best credentialed, who are most ambitious in a conventional sense. Because if you can sort of determine what reality looks like for them, you can certainly determine what's possible. I mean, if you're talking about people who want to become CEOs of major corporations, these are not going to be people who are not well-educated. And if part of the exploration is how rigid is the glass ceiling, it has to be looking at people who are fairly well-credentialed. But I did look at other groups as well. I mean, one of the more interesting small surveys I did was with a group from the Fortune Society, which is an organization that works with young people who are either have been incarcerated or have been diverted into other programs to avoid incarceration, and talk quite at length with them and similar groups as well. So the book does encompass more than just the elite groups.
Alfred in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alfred.
Hi, how are you?
Good, what's up?
Well, I feel like that, and this is probably not going to be very welcome, that abandoning the conversation of race or a glass ceiling might be in the best interest of black people. I mean, in a way, I feel like it's somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy when we continue to talk about it.
Yeah, that was what a number of the particularly younger respondents effectively said. The one woman I quoted earlier basically said, "I'm sick of all this talk of the glass ceiling." And actually, if you do believe fervently that a glass ceiling is in place, you're probably going to act like one is in place, and so it can potentially sabotage you that way of thinking. On the other hand, and particularly for older African Americans who entered the workforce at a time where there were in fact glass ceilings, where it was in fact impossible to achieve beyond a certain point. If they didn't have that belief in the glass ceiling, then they would not have a belief. They would in effect end up blaming themselves for failures that were not their fault.
But have you found in doing your research that the kind of the discourse, conversations, and I'm a 30-year-old black person, by the way. I'm in finance. Mm-hmm. I work in Manhattan. I'm self-employed. So,
sure.
You know, if there's going to be any kind of black ceiling that contributes toward, my limitations, I certainly would have seen them by now because I work in finance.
Sure.
And I'm self-employed. But do you believe the discourse and the meetings and, you know, and in talking about and discussing and writing books were perpetuating internally this idea that there is this And I look at my grandfather, I look at my mm-hmm. father, and I respect them because I understand the discrimination that they obviously had experienced in the past, and I respect that. But if I continue to contribute toward that, and I have that same attitude, I hold it on my shoulders, I don't feel like I'm doing them any justice or the black community, mm-hmm. any black community, quote unquote, any justice.
Alfred,
if I continue to wear that on my shoulders.
Thank you
very much.
How common is what he's saying among the believer class?
It's fairly common. I mean, and I don't disagree with him. I think that that African Americans, particularly well-educated African Americans under 40, have had a fundamentally different experience coming up. And that's part of the point of the book, than those who are older. And they've been much more likely to grow up competing with whites, much more likely to have grown up with white friends, much more likely to have come across whites who are not racist at all. And as a result, have a whole different take on what's going to be required of them in the workplace and how far they can go when they go into these various positions. But just to answer Alfred's question, I mean, no, I don't think that I'm perpetuating that mindset, because part of what the book will hopefully do is to encourage dialogue around this issue and intergenerational dialogue around this issue.
Lamar in Bedford-Stuyvesant. You're on WNYC. Hi, Lamar.
Oh, hello. How are you? And I think you're doing a great job, and your guest is really, really right on. I was talking to your screener, and my big issue being I'm a, you know, African-American, early 30s, and I'm a college professor. And I'm not – I mean, I know that situations are a lot better now, but I think that the whole idea of the end of anger – because I still am angry about a lot of things. I think it perpetuates kind of a complacency as to kind of this separate class, like you see in the African-American community, between the people who have and the people who don't. And I think in a lot of ways the release of anger – and I don't think that your host is perpetuating anything – your guest, I'm sorry, is not perpetuating anything. I think just the issue is that it kind of reinforces that big separation between the people who have and the people who don't, and that goes through a whole bunch of different ways, through social things, through everything else. Even in my neighborhood in Bedford-Stuyvesant, I see how a lot of the upper middle class black people kind of segregate themselves from people who are lower class, and I think that end of anger kind of doesn't help us kind of bridge that gap between our brothers and sisters who are struggling and those who have actually made it. So I don't know how your guest feels about that, or if you've kind of covered it.
Find out. Alex?
Sure. I mean, that's certainly an issue that I address in the book. I mean, the whole phenomena where we now have an increasing set of class divisions within the African-American community. I mean, if we go back, you know, to the olden days of intense segregation, we just didn't have those kinds of class divisions because everyone, in effect, was in the same boat. You know, everyone lived, there were nicer parts of communities and not so nice parts of communities, but essentially everyone lived in what was termed to be a ghetto at that point. We no longer have that set of circumstances, and we now also have a set of circumstances where you have a cadre of African Americans who function in a world totally apart from the traditional African American world. And I think all of this sets up, if not divisions, you know, certainly class differences that are not unlike the differences that every other ethnic group has.
There's even a more isolated, more ghettoized group of poor and poorly educated African Americans, as I say, more ghettoized, more isolated, maybe than ever before.
I think so. And I think one of the problems is that the very success of this, what I call the privileged class, this elite group, makes it easier to ignore the other group, makes it easier for at least some people to say, well, wait a minute, we are post-racial now. You know, we no longer have discrimination in this society. We no longer have issues of unequal access. So those poor people, you know, who are struggling must have done something wrong. It must be their fault. I think it makes it much easier for people who want to make that argument, which I think for any number of reasons is an incorrect argument to make that argument.
Barbara in Englewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to say that I believe the glass ceiling very much exists. I'm an educated black professional with a doctorate in education, and I have had a tremendously difficult time trying to permeate this glass ceiling that is perpetuated not only by whites, but also by blacks. My experience is that I have had blacks that have gone to tremendous effort to hinder my advancement.
Why would that be, in your opinion?
I think it goes back to the mentality that divided us in the beginning during slavery. The institutionalized belief of divide and conquer. I think that there are some of us who are so threatened by the advancement of others that we believe that there's not going to be a place for us if other blacks advance. And so in all of my years in education, 20 years, I have, in fact, had more black, especially females, go out of their way to hinder my advancement and to make things difficult for me than I have even white men.
Barbara, thank you for your call. Ellis, is this a dynamic that you write about in the book or have thought about?
Well, not in length, and I certainly can't speak to the caller's particular circumstance and what happened in her career. But what I will say, you know, is that since the book came out, I've read interesting headlines supposedly summing up what I have found. I've seen a headline which says Ellis Coe says racism is on the way out. I saw another headline which says Ellis Coe says that young blacks think the workplace is racism free. I haven't found any such thing. The majority of people of all ages in my survey seem to think there is some kind of glass ceiling. Much less so among those who are younger, and much more so among those who are older. What the big difference is that what those who are younger are much more likely to say is that, one, even though there's a glass ceiling in society, there's not one in the particular place where I work. And two, they're much more likely to say, in effect, yes, there's discrimination out there, but it's not so heavy and it's not so all-encompassing that I can't figure out a way to get where I want to go.
We're just about out of time, but I just want your thought on a stat that you mentioned that I've also read, which is that young African Americans are more optimistic about the future in polls than young whites.
That's true.
How far does it go, and what do you make of it?
It's not just true of young African Americans. This is true of African Americans of all ages and of all classes. I think a lot of it has to do with a taking stock of where we are in society. And by that, I mean in the 15 years since Rage came out, you had a series of things that happened. You had people like Richard Parsons, who was an African American who became chairman and CEO of Time Warner. You had people like Ken Chenault, who became CEO of American Express. You had people like Colin Powell, who became Secretary of State, and of course Condoleezza Rice, who also became Secretary of State. You had the ascension of Oprah, who consolidated her sort of role as the czarina of all things middlebrow. And then, of course, you had Barack Obama, and who ascended to the presidency, which was a position that many African Americans, perhaps most, thought they would never see an African American person ascend to in their lifetime. So what you have taking place, despite the awful economy, is people who are saying, well, my God, you know, there are things that are possible in this country that I never thought was possible before.
So optimism is relative to where you were yesterday.
Exactly.
Ellis Coe, his new book, The End of Anger, A New Generation's Take on Race and Rage. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, is President Obama breaking the law by keeping America in the Libya war beyond the 90 days specified in the War Powers Act? We'll get a take on that. Stay with us.